Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters, here on 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty. Mike Levins here. You could call in for questions with our panel, which would be Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia. Phil Duffy, a teacher at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on the Constitution, and Pastor David Whitney, all joining us, all involved in teaching the Constitution in their respective areas, even in a church. Pastor Dave, who's joined us on the phone in the past and consistently does. It's wonderful to have all of you with us as we talk about the Founders' Worldview, concluding the series with social issues on the Founders. Gary, how much have you poured into this?
Well, this was a hard one to conclude with because the Founders wrote extensively on some subjects. They love to write about government and politics but on social views not so much. I mean, there were certain social views that you really didn't talk about. They were just considered not subjects for polite company. When I say that these were the founders' social views, I have to be a little careful because they're not gleaned from the writings in many cases. They're gleaned from the way they constructed society, the laws they enacted, the laws they supported. And so you get a kind of a secondary view of their social issues or their social worldview by the way they constructed their society.
Now, as we begin here, we've referenced in the past the Nehemiah Institute's Peers Worldview Test. And looking at different social views, this delves into some different areas we're going to be talking about, such as the origin and nature of man, the value of life, which goes into abortion, even capital punishment, and even euthanasia. We're also even going to be looking at slavery and homosexuality, so we are running the gamut today as we talk about the Founders' worldview, their worldviews on all of these different topics, and how that, of course, was translated into our Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the foundations for our country in which we are so happy to be living today. Although that may be changing in a lot of respects, the foundation, for the most part, historically cannot and will not be changed. So as we look at the Peirce test and we vet all of these different topics, there is one that is left out, which is slavery. We're going to touch on that. But let's go into how did the founders, talking about slavery now, how did they look at the origin and nature of man? Because obviously that is implicit. Slavery is going to be touched by that topic, Gary.
Well, they saw man through the lens of the Bible, and they saw man, therefore, as a created being of an infinitely powerful God. I was really touched by finding on the Wall Builders website a couple quotes which really emphasized and reinforced that, particularly one from Thomas Jefferson, who we typically think, he's typically posited as a a deist or an atheist even, but he was quite far from that. And he has a letter to John Adams that he wrote 3 years before the both of them died on the 4th of July, 1826, in which he takes a wonderful view of a created universe, and he kind of inventories it in terms of all of its basic parts, the stars and the animals and the insects of, and all this perfect organization, which he says points to a creator, not a world that has spontaneously created itself, but definitely a creator who has a superintending power in keeping it all working. So this is definitely not the view of a deist. A deist believe that God created the universe and then went on holiday and just said, y'all work this out for yourselves, and doesn't therefore interact with his creation. But Jefferson's view definitely puts lie to that. Jefferson believed that even within 3 years of his death, he believed that there was a God who was still involved in his creation.
Now, Pastor David, you created the institution of the Constitution. Now, I'm sure, studied Thomas Jefferson because you're a pastor, and he's probably, as far as religion goes and debating the founders' religious worldviews, he's it. He's the be-all, end-all. So what do you say as far as Jefferson's worldviews?
Jefferson had a very, wide variety of different views he adopted at different points in time in his life. And so if you take the whole of Jefferson, you discover that he is not against Christianity in the ways that we have been led to believe. There are certain unorthodox aspects of his belief system at various points in his life. But largely, Jefferson, he stated that he was a Christian, that he believed the basic doctrines of the Christian faith. You know, we might disagree with him on some of those issues. But regarding this issue of mankind and creation, it's important to remember that creation was really at the foundation of the American view of law and government. After all, our Declaration of Independence, penned by Jefferson, states that it is because we are created that we have rights at all. That is, the very fact of creation, not evolution. Creation means there is a creator God who is the one, because he made us in his image, that has given us the right to life, to liberty, to property, pursuit of happiness. If we were not created, which is what is believed by many today and is taught in all the public education system, if we're not created, if we're evolved, the real question comes, where do your rights come from? And our founders' answer was very clear. They come from a creator, because you are not evolved. However, if you reject that foundation stone of creation, you have a huge problem, because you no longer have a basis for your rights. After all, if you really think about what evolution ultimately teaches, it teaches you only have power. You don't have rights. So the more powerful have an ability to kill the weaker, and indeed that's the kind of basis of indeed the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. Well, hey, you're more powerful. Your life is more important than the life of this baby within your womb, so go ahead and kill it, because you could choose to do that. You're the more powerful, you're the more evolved being. They are the less evolved being. So we need to remember that Jefferson's idea was the idea held by all of the founders. There is a creator God, first of all. Secondly, flowing from that, our rights come from him, the creator God. And thirdly, the only purpose of human civil government is to protect and to secure those God-given rights. That's the worldview of our founders, and what we at the Institute on the Constitution calls the American view. Those three things: creator God, rights come from him, the sole purpose of government is to secure those God-given rights.
The sixth president, John Quincy Adams, said this, quote, "But the first words of the Bible are, 'In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth.' The blessed and sublime idea of God as the creator of the universe, the source of all human happiness, for which all the sages and philosophers of Greece and Rome groped in darkness and never found, is recalled in the first verse of the book of Genesis. I call it the source of all human virtue and happiness, because when we have attained the conception of a being who, by the mere act of his will, created the world, it would follow as an irresistible consequence, even if we were not told that the same being must also be the governor of his own creation. That man, with all other things, was also created by him, and must hold his felicity and virtue on the condition of obedience to his will. John Quincy Adams penned that I just read there. If you have a question, by the way, for any of us, that would be Gary, that would be Phil, and myself. You could also throw a question at Pastor Dave here. That's 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255. The experts on the Constitution will be more than happy, that being Gary, Phil, and Pastor Dave, be more than happy to answer any questions you may have. 610-539-TALK. Phil, when we're looking at the origin and nature of man, that naturally goes into the value of life. Because like you pointed out, Pastor Dave, evolution, a worldview without God, just gives you power. It does not necessarily give you rights. Well, that translates into value as well. Where do we get our value from? Phil, your thoughts on the value of life in regards to origin and nature of man.
Well, I think it's solidly anchored into that biblical view. I think there's a curious parallel on this subject with the subject that we discussed last week, Obergefell versus Hodges, same-sex marriage, and the opinion of the Supreme Court, if I can kind of bring these thoughts to current day. Roe v. Wade and Obergefell are both based upon the discovery of the majority of the justices of new insights. These new insights are very important to those opinions. And both decisions reject prior wisdom in favor of these insights. And in the case of Roe v. Wade, the insight was that life began at birth and not conception. And no scientific proof was offered in 1973 when the opinion was handed down, by the way. And there's been plenty of scientific evidence since, including ultrasound proof of prepartum life. And that's subsequently been made available to the political community without any effect whatsoever. So if you look at this from a purely reasoning standpoint, Roe v. Wade remains an aberration of human reasoning. Life and death are mutually exclusive states. One cannot be simultaneously alive and dead. And the majority of justices were claiming, therefore, that the fetus was dead until it emerged from the mother, receiving oxygen from the atmosphere. And to be scientific, one would certainly have submitted to a rigorous testing protocol to make such a sharp departure from prior thinking, but that wasn't done. There was none of that, and the political agenda prevailed. So we're embroiled in a similar recent insight from the federal government that the adoption of education standards nationally will reverse negative education outcome trends. And again, we're faced with this deeply held conviction in these new untested insights that drives Common Core. And you know, the interesting thing about this is that it's bad enough when Supreme Court justices discover new law instead of interpreting the Constitution. But when they discover new biology, one has to really scratch one's head.
Like you said, can you be alive and dead at the same time? That they look at the fetus essentially as being dead until it is born and can breathe oxygen. I've said this before on different programs in this program. I guess I've not reached that level of enlightenment yet to be able to wrap my head around that fact. I guess it's a fact. I guess that's what they say it is. It is a fact, apparently, Phil.
At least a factoid.
It is a factoid. Well, as we look on, so this is drawing us into the value of life, how the founders looked at the value of life, and into abortion. Gary, the founders, did they even have abortion in their time?
Well, yes, they did. I mean, abortion has been around for a long, long time, back into before Christ even. But the founders knew what abortion was. They had, I'm not saying the founders themselves, but the people of the colonial period certainly knew abortion. They knew how to produce an abortion. There were various concoctions being used at the time. The problem was they were as deadly for the mother as the unborn child, oftentimes, and it was kind of a Russian roulette who was going to survive this thing. There was abortion, and it was commonly used for out-of-wedlock pregnancies. But because the colonies inherited English common law, under English common law, abortion was a crime. Now, there's one distinction we should make. Today, because of our science, we can know when those first stirrings of life occur at conception, and we can follow now through science the development of that unborn child through every stage of its development. They couldn't do that, of course, in the founding period. So they looked at the pregnancy period, and they saw a declension between when the child was moving in the womb and when it was not. They called that quickening. When the child made its first movements in the womb was called quickening. So there was a distinction between an abortion that was produced prior to quickening to one that was attempted after quickening. And before quickening, then an abortion, if it was discovered and prosecuted, was prosecuted as a misdemeanor. Whereas after quickening, it was prosecuted as a felony, as a felony offense, just like murder.
Now, what were the founders' worldview? Of course, we're looking at the consequences of English common law, but what were the founders' personal views when it came to abortion? Because it sounds the way that you're describing it, Gary, that it was pretty common, sad to say, almost as if the same as in our day, although more dangerous, maybe not as common because it was more dangerous.
Well, I wouldn't call it common. It was still a very rare event, judging from the times it was prosecuted. And unfortunately, I've not encountered any of the founders themselves written views on the subject of abortion, with a possible exception of Benjamin Rush, who wrote one letter about it, and he was a doctor, of course, so he brought a medical viewpoint into this, and he talks about this quickening period as a kind of a dividing line over how to treat abortion. But like I said, there were certain subjects that you just didn't talk about or write about in Plague Company, and I haven't found any of the founders themselves, other than Benjamin Rush, who really addressed this subject. But you got to look then at the laws. The legal structure definitely made it a crime. Throughout the entire 9 months of pregnancy, it was a crime to abort a child.
Now, there also was the other option, and this was probably something that, if not the founders did not plainly speak on, it would have been quite plain, I'm sure, their view, and it probably was looked at as a taboo, but infanticide. Was of course the more safe, if you want to say that, method of basically terminating an unwanted child, killing an unwanted child. This was, and you actually cite in your essay, Gary, you actually cite an example of this.
Well, yes, there was a charge of infanticide way back in 1629 in Jamestown, the first colony. To be really successful, a lady was charged with having killed her newborn baby, but there was insufficient evidence to try her, so the charges were dropped. But later on in Massachusetts, the colonists of the time actually executed a woman, a Miss Martin, for infanticide, for killing her newborn baby. And she confessed to doing it, so the evidence was pretty compelling, and she was executed for that. So it was a capital offense to kill your newborn baby.
That kind of paints a picture of how the founders would have looked at the value of life in their time. Of course, abortion and infanticide, some would go, there's a huge era of distinction there, but others may not. Pastor Dave, I want to get your views on that as regards to the value of life from our founders' point of view.
Well, thank you, because our founders are very clear that the foundational God-given right, given to us by our Creator is the right to life. And basically, if you don't have the right to life, then none of your other rights are of any significance at all. You're obviously not going to be able to exercise your right to own property or your right to liberty if you don't have the right to life. In fact, if you consider what our founders structured in what they designed in our constitutional government, the whole purpose of government was to protect the God-given right to life. And indeed, if a government failed to protect the God-given right to life, what they detailed, of course, in our Declaration of Independence, it is really the duty of the people in such a society where the government fails to protect the God-given right to life. It is the duty of the people to alter or to abolish that government. And in fact, that's what they were stating in the Declaration of Independence. Of course, in the Declaration, they were not charging King George III with failing to protect the God-given right to life. They have 27 other grievances, 27 other violations of God-given rights. But they were saying to us in our day, if the civil government is about the task of not protecting the God-given right to life of anyone in society, then that civil government is an illegitimate government. They said of King George III, after the list of 27 grievances, they said, he is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. And so if we could apply their standard to what we face today, ever since Roe v. Wade, 1973, since that point in the history of this country, this government has been unfit to be the ruler of a free people because it not only refuses to protect the God-given right to life, it actually engages itself as a party in the murder of the unborn in our society. Now, most estimates reach about 60 million murders that have taken place since Roe v. Wade. So we have a duty to alter or to abolish this current government and to restore a government that would protect the God-given right to life.
Now, let's shift gears and go to capital punishment, because this all falls under the value of life. Phil, we've got about 2 minutes left before we've got to head to our halfway point in the show, our break. But tell me, you know, capital punishment, I just, you know, Gary, I'm drawing off your essay here, but General George Washington routinely hung British spies. We have the Crimes Act of 1790, which mandated execution for a variety of crimes. The U.S. Coinage Act of 1792 made counterfeiting a capital offense. Phil, some more insight on that, would you?
Well, I don't know that I can add much more insight than Gary has already offered on this subject. I'd like to point out that there is a distinction between military justice and civil justice, and under the context of military justice, the idea of capital punishment seems to be more acceptable than under civil justice. And I think it was Benjamin Rush who had some reservations about any kind of capital punishment whatsoever. I mean, clearly today our society is struggling with this thought, with a great deal of emphasis now being placed on the elimination of capital punishment totally.
And Gary, we are looking at that as a current issue. In the Founders' Day, though, as an example, George Washington, who is very known, at least in our modern day, for his Christian views, and many people cite him for that, as you wrote in the essay, routinely hung British spies.
Well, yes, he did, and he didn't have any compulsion about it. Benedict Arnold, I'm drawing a blank on which British spy we actually captured.
Well, yeah, we're heading to the break. And just to kind of, as we approach the break, here's a quote. Thomas Jefferson wrote this in a letter to Edward Pendleton. Punishments I know are necessary, and I would provide them, strict and inflexible, but proportioned to the crime. Death might be inflicted for murder and perhaps for treason, if you would take out of the description of treason all crimes which are not such in their nature. Rape, buggery, punished by castration. We're going to talk about that. We're going to continue the conversation on the value of life in regards to the Founders' worldview on We the People, the Constitution Matters here on 1180 WFYL.
Working for your liberty, right? shining bright from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station, WFYL.
Fox News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. The Confederate battle flag comes down at the South Carolina State Capitol in Columbia this morning with a bill ordering it removed signed by Governor Nikki Haley. Opinions are mixed.
It's tyranny and big government when they went on their own whim and decided what to do with it.
People in South Carolina are coming together. It's wonderful for our state.
A short ceremony scheduled at 10 o'clock Eastern with the flag eventually moved to a Confederate shrine to be built as part of a compromise. The Super Bowl champion quarterback Ken Stabler died.
Stabler was in Mississippi battling colon cancer at the time of his death. Ken the Snake Stabler spent 10 seasons under center for Oakland, earning most valuable player honors in 1974 and leading the Raiders to a Super Bowl victory in 1977. The four-time Pro Bowler was 69.
Fox's Will Carr. Fox News. We report. You decide.
Hey, Grandma, can you help me with my Common Core lesson on the Constitution? But the only part we're reading in eighth grade is the preamble and the First Amendment. I wonder when we'll get to study the rest of it. Didn't you say our founding fathers were wise patriots and wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect our freedom? This Common Core book we're reading says our founding fathers were racist and they didn't think women or blacks should ever be allowed to vote. She says, we the people. Didn't really mean you and me, but some rich white guys. That just makes me feel terrible about our country. We need to change things.
Oh, honey, that's not true at all. Our country is the greatest country the world has ever seen, and our founding fathers worked hard to be fair to everyone. I'm going to call our school board and our state board of education and ask why they allow Common Core and this book in your school.
Call your representatives now and ask them to stop Common Core and restore local control. Pennsylvanians Against Common Core brought you this message. Go to nopacommoncore.com or call 484-678-2236.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning and welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters here on 1180 WFYL. Mike Levins here, along with Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia, Phil Duffy, a teacher on the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, and Pastor David Whitney, founder of the Institute on the Constitution, all joining us via phone. You can join us as well by calling in at 610-539-TALK. Let your voice be heard this morning and ask a question as we're talking about the founders' worldviews on social issues, and we're just wrapping up a thought that Pastor David had on capital punishment.
Well, thank you, Mike. You know, as I teach it at the Institute on the Constitution, often people look at what our founders believed in light of what we believe today and say, boy, that's kind of strange or that's unusual. And particularly here on the issue of abortion and capital punishment, they're the exact opposite of many people in our society today that believe, well, you know, killing a baby that's unwanted, that's fine, but letting a person who's convicted of a capital crime, such as murder, letting that person live in prison for life is the just thing to do. Well, our the opposite view, but I think our founders had a better grasp on justice. Consider this. Is the baby in the womb innocent or guilty? Quite obviously, the baby is innocent. They've committed no crime. Is the criminal who is convicted of having committed murder, let's say, is he guilty or innocent? Obviously, he is guilty, even if he's in prison for the rest of his life. So our founders said, let's protect the life of the innocent unborn baby, and let's execute the guilty murderer. Where today in our society, it's exactly the opposite. We execute 60 million of the innocent unborn babies, while we let most of the murderers, well, they remain in prison maybe the rest of their life, but many of them get out of prison, we let the murderers off the hook. They don't have to pay with their life for having taken another precious human life. So I think our founders had justice, a far better grasp of justice than most people do today in our society.
Well, as we go into justice, we're getting into justice on numerous topics. We're talking about all sorts of social issues this morning, the next of which lined up for the tally. We just finished capital punishment. That was David's thought there on capital punishment in regards to today and the contradiction or the difference between the Founders' Day and our day, the origin and nature of man, how much value there is in life. Now, let's talk about their views on sexuality, because that has become an issue of public discussion in the form of homosexual marriage. But let's just talk about sexuality in general. We're going to touch on homosexuality a little bit as well. But Gary, tell us about the founders' views on this idea of sexuality. Our society is very sexual today. Everyone would argue that. What would the founders think?
Well, they would take their views from the Bible, that that sexuality is an exclusive activity within marriage. And marriage being a covenant between a man and a woman and God, that covenant was not to be lightly abridged. And when it was to be punished. So premarital sex, extramarital sex, was a criminal act. And in some cases, in Puritan New England, you sometimes paid for that with your life, adultery. So it was a biblical worldview, definitely, in that regard. And now, did it occur? Still, yes. Despite sanctions, abortion occurred. Despite sanctions, extramarital sex occurred. Alexander Hamilton very famously had an extramarital affair, and as a Christian, he was troubled by this when it was exposed, and he wrote a very public pamphlet that explained, in his view, what had happened. It didn't necessarily justify it, but he took the steps of explaining his actions, at least in a public way. We learned only after Governor Morris died that he had kept a very detailed diary, and in it he had expounded upon several affairs that he had had. So it did occur. We have to acknowledge that, but there were social sanctions and legal sanctions against it. So the community didn't just say, well, that's okay, as we do today.
I like how you start this in the essay. You start with judging the founders' views on sex as a challenge. It was not a topic much discussed in polite company, neither in their letters, taking some verbiage they probably would use at the time. Not discussed in polite company. I like that. Well, Phil, give us some enlightenment here. Of course, we had Thomas. Of course, we had Alexander Hamilton, and his case. But let's look at. There was a committee commissioned by the Thomas Jefferson Heritage Society. After reviewing essentially the same material, reached different conclusions, namely that Sally Hemings was the only minor figure in Thomas Jefferson's life, and that it is very unlikely he fathered any of her children. This committee also suggested in its report, issued in April 2001 and revised in 2011, that Jefferson's younger brother Randolph was more likely the father of at least some of Sally Hemings' children. That's an interesting stage for you to chime in on sexuality as the founder saw it, Phil.
Well, I'm not a geneticist, so I can't make a judgment between the two individuals. As a layman, I understand there is a possibility, because Thomas Jefferson and his brother Randolph probably would have shared some DNA, and I believe it's DNA evidence that is being relied upon to associate Sally Hemings with Jefferson. But other than that, I think we're into the area of pure speculation on this, and I doubt that we're going to get the answer during our lifetimes.
No, most certainly, and that's something that's brought up with Jefferson quite a bit as far as his slaves. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, I just wanted to say that there are certain elements that would like to disparage the founders, and when these claims of having fathered Sally Hemings' children were first postulated, even during his time, I mean, this was nothing new, but these charges came out during his lifetime. But today they're used to disparage the founders, and you can still find this claim on many websites that Jefferson did in fact father these children. What they seem to ignore is the fact that this conclusive DNA evidence, as it was first postulated, was quietly withdrawn without much fanfare, and is no longer scientifically supportable. Jefferson has been vindicated, but a lot of people don't want to accept that.
Now, let's briefly, and then we're going to go into slavery, which is going to take a good portion of our time. But homosexuality had just as harsh consequences, if we're looking at the puritanical laws of the day, had just as harsh consequences as being sexually promiscuous. Pastor David, I'd like you to take this one.
Well, thank you. We've already referred to the Thomas Jefferson letter where he talks about punishments, particularly talks about capital punishments for capital crimes. And he lists there in his letter buggery, which is a term we're not familiar with, but it is sodomy is what buggery is. And he recommends, and actually in his proposed legislation, he advised castration as the punishment for buggery. Because obviously, if you cut off the offending member, the person is not going to be able to commit that crime ever again. So our founders are very clear that this sin of sodomy was not something that was in any way acceptable. It was against the Creator's design, against the laws of nature, and therefore ought not to be tolerated in society, ought to be punished in a severe fashion that would discourage anyone from ever attempting it again. And we have the record here of George Washington drumming out of the military this detestable person who detestably acted in an attempted act of sodomy against another soldier in the military. So military discipline was enacted, although he was not physically punished for that crime. Our founders had no qualms about stating that God's design for sexual morality was one man and one woman, and that everything else, whether it's adultery, fornication, and buggery, sodomy, as they labeled it, all of these were vicious crimes that needed to be treated harshly to prevent anyone from being tempted to go down that road.
Now, to kind of add to the picture that you painted there as far as, and thank you for the description of buggery. I know I read that before in the first segment. If you would like to call in with a question, you could do so, by the way, for the experts that we have on the Constitution, as each of them are Gary, Phil, and Pastor David. 610-539-TALK, the number to call, 610-539-TALK. Now, this is George Washington's view of the matter, and Gary, I want to go to you with this one. His Excellency, the Commander-in-Chief, approves the sentence, and this, by the way, to give you a picture of what was going on, he approved the dismissal from the service of one Lieutenant Enslin of, Colonel Malcolm's Regiment. Colonel Malcolm's Regiment, for attempting to commit sodomy with a soldier. He said, quote, "His Excellency the Commander-in-Chief approves the sentence, and with abhorrence and detestation of such infamous crimes, orders Lieutenant Enslin to be drummed out of camp tomorrow morning by all the drummers and fifers in the army, never to return."
Yep, that was a very dishonorable way of leaving the army, for sure. There it is.
It's, I guess, pretty plain. It speaks for itself as far as, and this was just, these are to paint a picture of the founders' views. Now, let's go into slavery. Gary, this was a hot issue in the founders' day.
It was indeed, and I should point out, and David Barton points out quite eloquently, that the founders were born into and is a society which had already embraced slavery. It's not something they invented, of course. They almost all inherited their slaves upon the deaths of their fathers. Jefferson did that. He inherited others when he married Martha Wales. So it's not that they went down to the pier and started buying slaves. They kind of grew into this institution as they grew older and inherited estates. But they definitely recognized the inhumanity of it. And Jefferson wrote a very extensive selection for the Declaration of Independence that criticized the slave trade and pointed his finger directly at the king for encouraging it. That section wasn't retained in the final document because the southern states weren't going to sign up to that, but at least he made an attempt, and he made other attempts as a legislator in Virginia to do away with the practice. But they all realized that you couldn't get rid of slavery overnight without completely wrecking the economy. Jefferson termed it having the ear of a wolf. You can't really control them, and you can't let go of that ear either without doing great damage. So it was a sticky situation. They did what they could, and they attempted to put it out of society. Now, Phil, I know, has done some research in this area. So, Phil, what would you add to that?
Well, I believe the comments that you've made about the attitudes towards slavery at our nation's founding create some balance to the subject. And unfortunately, when we get into a subject like this, there's too much of this binary thinking, looking for good guys and bad guys. And that is a real disservice, I believe, to the pursuit of the truth. It's certainly a distortion to claim that the founding fathers were racists. The truth is far more complex, as you've pointed out. But I think that we've got to come back to the principles in something like this instead of drifting off into guilt by association. And we can turn to both founding documents for the truth on this matter. And the Declaration of Independence, as Pastor David pointed out earlier, says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Pretty clear statement. Man or men in this context is a synonym for persons, of course, so it is clear that slavery contradicted the fundamental principles of the Declaration of Independence. But then you get into the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, which has subsequently been corrected, by the way, with Amendments 13 to 15. But it's interesting to see what the thinking was at that time at the Constitutional Convention. And it says that representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. Well, who are those other persons? Those were slaves who were still denied their liberty and pursuit of happiness. There was a contradiction there. And, correcting that contradiction took us through a bloody civil war. Now, Gary mentioned Jefferson's statement about slavery. I'd like to read it because I think you see a little bit of waffling here by Jefferson. He says, "There is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us from this heavy reproach in any practical way. We have the wolf by the ear, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is in one scale and self-preservation in the other." He's kind of detached himself from this issue. And, I generally admire Jefferson. I think he was an intellectual giant. But if he was also a troubled man who held slaves for his own benefit, We can't deny that. And so I find his remark a little disingenuous, and also a reminder that all humans have feet of clay. This is the best way, I think, to look at history, to recognize, and it's interesting, I think, that the discussions opened up on the creation view, the biblical creation view, and the byproduct thought that fallen man is not to be trusted with political power. And that's the basic idea here. We've got to look at all individuals as being susceptible to that fault.
The argument now being made, or that is changing history in some respects, in other respects not. It's a complex social issue of the day, slavery, but the claim that the founders were racist, which is something that we don't necessarily find across the board, Pastor Dave.
Well, yes, that's true. And could I just back up for a second, because I want to add one refinement to what we've discussed thus far. When we come to the 13th Amendment, everyone says that slavery was ended. But read the actual text sometime of the 13th Amendment, you'll discover only private slavery was ended. The 13th Amendment fully envisioned the continuation of public slavery, that is, government-held slaves. That is, those who are convicted of some crime can be held as slaves by the civil government. And indeed, if you look at America today and compare it to the rest of the world, we have more prisoners per capita than any other country in the entire world. More prisoners per capita than Cuba, more prisoners per capita than China, than Russia, any other country. We have the biggest slave population per capita of any country in the world. And by the way, that is an extremely profitable business. Those who are in the business of not only building prisons, those who are in the business of using the labor of prisoners, for which the prisoners are compensated pennies on the hour, that kind of thing. There is a prison system today that is slavery, but most Americans don't recognize it. Only private slavery was done away with. Public, that is government-run slavery, was fully established by the 13th Amendment. And I think it's a crime that our civil government profits off of the slave system of people who really are in prison for most often drug-related offenses. So they had a little bit of marijuana in their car or whatever. I don't agree with smoking marijuana or doing anything of that sort, but putting people behind bars and enslaving them simply for owning a little bit of some drug or another and not actually committing any violent crimes, I think is a huge mistake. Well, going back to the issue of racism, again, Jefferson stated clearly all men are created equal, which, as Phil has said, created the difficulty for him of saying, I've got these people that I have enslaved and or have inherited as slaves. I'm maintaining them in their slavery. How am I honoring the fact that they're created in the image of God? And while we struggle with what Jefferson was looking at, we need to also recognize that he was talking about the wolf by the ears in the other aspect that what happens if you simply emancipate your slaves? We might think from our perspective, oh, that would be a great thing, just emancipate those slaves. Where are they going to get a job? Where are they going to get housing? Where are they going to get clothing and food, particularly in states that would not receive slaves? One of the things that facts that people don't know is that many of the northern states, just before the war that took place, that great war between the states, northern states refused to allow any free blacks within their territories. In fact, Abraham Lincoln, as a legislator in the state of Illinois, voted for such legislation and would say, we will not allow any free blacks into our territory whatsoever. Why? They knew those free blacks would come and work for lower wages. That is, they would undercut the labor pool that currently existed in the state of Illinois, and they didn't want that competition in the area of labor.
There were, of course, many practical...
Slavery was a very difficult thing because of the economic realities. So how are these slaves going to actually provide for themselves if they are simply emancipated and set free?
There were, of course, many practical considerations, Pastor Dave, and that was one of the things that the founders had to struggle with. You draw an interesting correlation there as far as with the prison system today and slavery and the allowance in the 13th Amendment for public slavery. That's an interesting thought. Phil, you're the one who's done study on this. Your thoughts on that?
That's a very interesting perspective. I had never thought of it. and one that requires, I think, some investigation and thought. Excellent thought.
Gary, we wanted to devote a good amount of time, I guess, because of the charge that has been levied against the founders that they were indeed just racist white men, which kind of inhibits all kind of investigation to produce any fruit.
Well, let's look at Washington, for an example, because I think it typifies exactly the paradox they face. Washington had a favorite manservant, Billy Lee, who went with him everywhere and accompanied him throughout the entire Revolutionary War period. Billy Lee was every bit the horseman that Washington was, and had to be, because Washington was one of the best horsemen of the colonies of the time, and to keep up with him on a horse required great skill. So Billy Lee went with him everywhere, even appears in paintings of Washington of the time. He was such a constant companion. So when Washington dies, or as he's preparing to die, he puts in his will the stipulation that Billy Lee, and only Billy Lee, will be freed upon his death. Now, that seems unusual, but then you consider what would have happened to Martha Washington upon the death of George. Martha Washington would be left, if Washington had freed all of his slaves at his death, Martha Washington would be destitute. Now, that wouldn't be right for her. It wouldn't be becoming of him to leave his wife destitute by freeing all of his slaves and giving her no means of support or maintain ability to maintain the estate. So Washington then stipulated in his will that Billy Lee would be freed upon his death, but the remaining slaves would be freed upon Martha's death. So she would be cared for as his responsibility was as the father and husband. He would care for make sure that her needs were cared for until her death.
Now, to kind of, in defense of Washington here, people who may say, well, he was still leaving slaves, he should have just freed them all. Well, you're automatically assuming that Washington keeping his slaves meant that he whipped them with a stick and that he did all the horrible atrocities that were happening with many other slave owners in the colonies. That's what you're assuming. What you're not assuming, or what you're not thinking about, is that possibly they wanted to stay as slaves. They were being treated well by Washington, and they actually had a place to stay. They had a wage. They had food, which was something that he was doing for them. So that's the flip side of the argument. We're wrapping up a program today. Go ahead, Javier. I'll let you have the last word.
Just a final thought on that. When Washington came back from the White House serving as president, there was 300 slaves on his plantations. Only 100 of those slaves were actually physically working, laboring slaves. Some of those were too young to yet work productively. Others were already in retirement years, and he was maintaining them, giving them a retirement on his plantation.
Well, that's the last word on the Founders Worldview on social issues, and what a series. We've gone through everything. Religion, social issues, politics, we've hit it all. You're listening to We the People, the Constitution Matters. We'll see you next week, 7 to 8, right here on 1180 WFYL.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFYL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Live from beautiful West Norriton Township. Norriton Township. This is AM 1180. AM 1180. WFYL.
King of Prussia.
Philadelphia.